This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, a new effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. It's been a long time since I've been this excited about a new natural medical innovation. Zona Plus is the real deal. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure naturally. To find out more, go to tryzonanow.com or call toll-free 1-866-669-9662. Be sure to mention Dr. Hoffman and you'll get a $50 savings and free shipping. That's 1-866-669-9662 or tryzonanow.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to cover a very important subject. It is Lyme disease, or more precisely, tick-borne disease. The mystery of Lyme disease, because, if you have a classic presentation of Lyme disease, if you have a bullseye rash, or you feel you've got a terrible fever and you're treated early and successfully, Lyme disease is eminently curable. But for a significant number of individuals exposed to tick bites, they experience long-term illness. Lyme disease is very challenging to A, diagnose, B, treat, and there's even controversy about whether these people who are sick long-term are actually suffering from Lyme disease or whether they're suffering from other problems. So today I'm going to talk to one of my favorite experts on the subject of Lyme disease-related conditions. He's Dr. Brian Fallon. Dr. Fallon is a board-certified psychiatrist. That, however, does not mean that it's all in your head, but we'll take a look at that dimension too. He's director of the Center for Neuroinflammatory Disorders and Biobehavioral Medicine, and he's director of the Lyme and Tick-Borne Disease Research Center at Columbia University here in New York City. Dr. Fallon, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
Well, I'm very glad to be here. Thanks.
So that's a mouthful. Neuroinflammatory disorders and biobehavioral medicine. So you know, what that suggests is that there's an inflammatory component. There's a psychiatric component. So perhaps start with a definition of something called PTLS. What is PTLS?
Sure. Post-treatment Lyme syndrome. And post-treatment Lyme syndrome is the term that's given to those patients who have symptoms that develop within the first 6 months of getting Lyme disease, infected with the agent of Lyme disease, and then persists despite antibiotic treatments. And typically, those symptoms would be problems with cognition, prominent fatigue, or prominent pain. There can be a variety of other symptoms as well, but those are the most common. There's debate as to whether they have to occur within the first 6 months or whether it might occur during the first year after the initial infection. So, for example, if someone gets an infection and then 8 months later starts getting verbal fluency problems and they can't find the word to say what they wish to say, or if they start getting diffuse muscle pains or joint pains, or they start getting really prominent fatigue, does that mean they don't have post-treatment Lyme syndrome? So I think the duration of 6 months is somewhat arbitrary, but the point is that there are symptoms that persist despite having received the standard level of care of antibiotics recommended by the Infectious Disease Society of America.
Right. And that's where it seems the battle lines are drawn, because there are some who are individuals in the infectious disease community who set the standards for how you're supposed to treat Lyme disease. And they say, look, you know, you need a course of antibiotics and that should take care of it. And if you're not well, you're not still suffering from Lyme disease, and you may be suffering from other problems, or you may be suffering from a poorly understood aftermath of Lyme disease, but you don't deserve any more antibiotics. And then there are what are called the Lyme literate physicians, And they belong to groups like ILADS, the International Lyme, whatever that stands for, a group that advocates sometimes long-term treatment with antibiotics for suspected Lyme disease or tick-borne disorders. And I think there's it's a real furious controversy that divides health professionals and patients on this critical issue.
You're absolutely right. It's been a very difficult scene for patients as well as for the physicians who care for those patients, partly because we have inadequate diagnostic tests. I mean, the ideal situation would be we would have a diagnostic test that would tell us, number one, if a person was previously infected with the agent of Lyme disease, but more importantly, whether they currently have active infection. And our current tests do not allow us to make that distinction. And because of that, when a patient comes into the office with having had Lyme disease and they have persistent symptoms, the physician wants to know, does this person have persistent infection or do they not? And unfortunately, the test doesn't tell you. It just tells you whether they've had a previous infection. So that's the problem. Another problem with the tests is that not everybody tests positive, even if they have had Lyme disease. And there are a variety of reasons why that might be. But that also creates conundrum because that creates anxiety. If you have diffuse musculoskeletal pains and you have marked fatigue and you have brain fog, well, that might be due to past Lyme or current Lyme, or it could be due to depression, or it could be due to another rheumatological disorder. So there's a variety of disorders that have that same constellation of symptoms, and if you don't have a test that can tell you whether or not it's active Lyme disease, you are operating from a very limited realm of knowledge.
And there are so many tests out there that sometimes patients who are desperate for an answer go from one doctor to another, and eventually they see a doctor who may be a little bit biased towards the Lyme disease diagnosis because that's what they treat. And eventually, they'll find a test that shows some trace, some scintilla of an antibody or some sort of residual protein that is associated with Lyme, and then they'll say, okay, you know, you need the treatment.
That's right. I mean, that's right. So then the patient, the physician will talk about the possibility of Lyme disease, and a treatment will be initiated, and sometimes, if you're lucky, the patient's symptoms will go away, and then the hypothesis was correct that this was, or at least you can't say for sure it was correct, but you can certainly say the antibiotics led to a resolution of the symptoms. But that's sort of guesswork, and a lot of physicians have to work within that realm because that's the limitation of our current diagnostics. Now, when I think of patients with chronic symptoms, I think of four overlapping circles, and one circle is persistent infection. Another circle is unrecognized co-infection.
Co-infection, can you go into that in a little bit more detail? In other words,
sure.
The first circle would be like you didn't kill the bug. The bug is hiding somewhere in your body. It hasn't been successfully treated. And actually, you've done some, or your center at Columbia has done some work that shows that at least sometimes in animal models, even treating animals for a while with antibiotics, there is some residual Lyme that kind of hides in deep in recesses in the body that may not be responsive to even high-dose antibiotics given initially.
Well, I mean, just to be clear, we haven't done that research, but other groups around the country have done outstanding research in that area. So, for example, UC Davis, University of California, Davis, have done some wonderful mouse studies to show that there are, in fact, Borrelia or spirochetes that persist after treatment and that they start to reemerge about 9 or 10 months later, at least in the mouse model. And similarly, at Tulane University, Dr. Embers and her group with Dr. Philippe have looked at the rhesus macaque, which is a type of monkey, and they've found persistent infection in that model of animal model after treatment. So one of the biggest revolutions that I think that has occurred in Lyme disease over the last 10 years really was the papers that came out in 2008 and 2010 that proved that the infection does indeed persist in the animal model. Now, this actually was demonstrated way back about 10 years earlier in another in a Beagle study from out of Cornell. But because it was done by an individual who was then somewhat junior faculty, or maybe it was his graduate thesis, I can't recall. Even though it was published in a really good journal, people didn't pay that much attention to it. The community clinicians did, because it resonated with their experience that some patients do indeed benefit with repeated antibiotics. But the academics really largely ignored it until 2008, when this preeminent researcher at UC Davis, Dr. Bartel, published this paper that really shook up the academic community and made them realize, oh my gosh, we were wrong.
Right.
Indeed, the spirochete can persist despite antibiotic treatment. So that was really fantastic, because it galvanized academics to suddenly to take a fresh look at this question. And it has recently led, like the Global Lyme Alliance in Connecticut has funded two prominent researchers, Dr. Lewis, and a number of researchers, but among which are Dr. Lewis at Northeastern and Dr. Zhang at Johns Hopkins. And they've done really extraordinary work in vitro, showing that the standard antibiotics for Lyme actually are not killing all of the spirochetes, and there's some that are left, and those are called persisters. And so the next step they did was to go through a huge data bank that they have of pharmaceutical compounds to see what would work to kill these persisters. And they've been looking at different combinations of antibiotics and other agents to try to kill these persister microbes. So what I find exciting and promising and hopeful is that there, including the work we're doing here at Columbia, which is focusing more on the brain and the neural networks that I want to talk about in a little bit, but the persistent infection stuff is really key, and it may indeed lead to more effective treatments for humans in the not-too-distant future. So that's really great news. So that's the persistent circle of the four-circle model.
Right. So I just want to make one comment, is that recently you're well aware that the New England Journal had a lead article which actually explored the possibility that long-term antibiotics might be more effective than just a short course of initial antibiotics. And as you well know, the study came up short. It did not show any benefit, at least with their particular cocktail of antibiotics given over several weeks after initial treatment. In other words, both groups got initial treatment, and then one group got, you know, a cocktail of antibiotics long term, and it didn't make a difference. So, what's your take on that particular study and studies like that?
Yeah, well, you know, every study contributes something valuable, and this is actually a very interesting study. It was done out of the Netherlands, to their credit, it was a large study. They had 280 patients in it, it was not a study designed to answer the question, does repeated antibiotic treatment work in patients who have been previously treated? So it does not answer that question, because they didn't design the study to answer that question.
Mm-hmm.
They designed the study to answer the question, if we give everybody who's been previously treated 2 weeks of treatment with intravenous antibiotic.
I think it was Rocephin they used, right? Rocephin?
Rocephin, that's exactly right. And then they randomly assigned them either to an additional 12 weeks of doxycycline, or 12 weeks of Biaxin plus Plaquenil, or 12 weeks of placebo. And then what they were really asking, does extended oral antibiotic treatment after 2 weeks of IV treatment help? And their study pretty clearly showed that in this group of 280 patients, there was no difference in outcome between the different groups. But what I found interesting, and I know a lot of others who have looked at this study have found interesting, is that everybody, in fact, in the study, or at least the group effect, each of the groups improved significantly compared to where they were before they got the 2 weeks of IV ceftriaxone.
Right. So the Rocephin did something.
So you would say, well, was that time alone, just the passage of time, and it would have gotten better anyway? Well, that's possible, but you would need a placebo group from the very beginning to be able to answer that question.
Okay.
So as long as you interpret the study based on the way the study was designed and don't overinterpret, then I think this is a valuable study in showing that at least in this group of patients, the extended antibiotic therapy didn't help.
But you would not say that this study is the death knell for the use of long-term antibiotics in patients who are persistently sick after a Lyme disease diagnosis?
Well, I mean, death knell means that you've excluded all possibilities and you've enrolled the exactly correct sample of patients and you've used the most effective antibiotic combination. That would be a death knell.
Okay.
And, you know, each study contributes something. So this study tells you exactly what they did. So it does tell you that doxycycline after 2 weeks of Rocephin or Baxin and Plaquenil after 2 weeks of Rocephin did not contribute significantly to outcomes. So you might say that it really is a downer for those who believe that that's the best approach for these patients.
Mm-hmm.
But it does offer the possibility that, or at least it supports the notion that perhaps repeated antibiotic treatment can be helpful.
Okay.
It doesn't mean you have to go on for 14 weeks, but perhaps 2 weeks of IV, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a very interesting study because of that. Now, the other somewhat problematic aspect of this study was that they had a very wide range of patients they included in the study, including some who most researchers here in the United States wouldn't even say would qualify for a study of post-treatment Lyme syndrome. So,
and it's a European experience. It would have been nicer if they did the study in Connecticut or Massachusetts.
Well, I think we need more studies here in the United States. You know, so I think this is a helpful study. The way I sort of view the clinical trials is that the best clinical trial in terms of most favorable clarity in terms of outcome, positive outcome, was Dr. Krupp's study at Stony Brook, which showed that 1 month of IV ceftriaxone did indeed benefit the patients three times more often than 1 month of IV placebo for those patients who had post-treatment Lyme fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
And then my study was looking at
cognition. And you did a study, I think it was 2009 that you did a study, right? Yeah,
that's right. And published that study in the Journal of Neurology. And we wanted to ask, we were looking at brain imaging, but we also wanted to look at treatment to see if treatment resulted in improvement. So we did use extended treatment. We used 10 weeks of IV ceftriaxone compared to 10 weeks of IV placebo. And our primary interest was in what's called encephalopathy, or those patients who have cognitive problems, memory
mm-hmm.
problems after having had well-documented Lyme disease. And our study results on that question were somewhat disappointing. At 12 weeks, which is our primary outcome, they were marginally improved.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is they lost their gains when they came off.
So short-term improvement, but then they kind of relapsed.
Yeah, but sustained.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is when we were writing that paper, the reviewers in neurology asked us, would you please analyze your data using the same exact approach that Dr. Krupp used at Stony Brook for her data and you know, use the same enrollment criteria, et cetera. And we could do that because we used the same measures. And what we found were identical results, that about three times as many people responded with sustained improvements in fatigue at 6 months compared to those who received IV placebo. So
mm-hmm.
when I look at that, I can't say, I can say that this certainly supported the results of the Stony Brook study. So in my mind, it's a pretty solidly based in evidence that repeated antibiotic therapy can help patients with persistent fatigue
mm-hmm.
After having been treated for Lyme disease. But you know, what we need really are better biomarkers to figure out who are the patients
mm-hmm.
who would most likely benefit from this repeated antibiotic treatment? Because, as we all know, we don't want to use antibiotics randomly, and we don't want to use antibiotics unnecessarily. And antibiotics change the gut microbiome, and so we don't even know yet what all these antibiotics are doing to the GI tract. And there's a clear interaction between the GI tract and the immune system and including neurological impacts. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot we don't know, so we want to be careful.
Right.
But I can say that, at least from my perspective, there is a benefit of repeated antibiotic treatment for post-human Lyme fatigue. Now, Dr. Klempner and his group up at Tufts did a large study, and they did not find any improvement with repeated antibiotic therapy. So, there, you know, I think each study contributes something, but in the United States, treatment guidelines have been promulgated and based, at least for post-treatment Lyme syndrome, on a total sample size of roughly about 200 patients. And, you know, that wouldn't be done, or that usually isn't done with other diseases.
Right.
Usually you have thousands of patients who are studied. So, as a researcher likes to say, more work needs to be done.
Yeah. I'll let you get on to circle number two, because you're about to talk about co-infections and the possibility that when people don't get better, we may have successfully treated their Lyme disease, but missed the boat on something else.
That's right. So these ticks have been called cesspools of infection because it's been shown by my colleague here at Columbia, Rafael Tokars, that about a third of the ticks in Connecticut and the New York area carry more than one human disease-causing organism. So they might be carrying the agent of babesiosis or the agent of anaplasmosis or another less common disease. And so it's
Ehrlichiosis,
a third of the ticks.
Yeah,
so exactly. Ehrlichiosis, there's Borrelia miyamotoi, which is a new form of Borrelia, which was recently recognized, which causes a Lyme-like illness, but isn't necessarily detected on the current tests. So, and then there are viruses that the ticks can carry as well. So, for example, the Powassan virus is carried by about 2% of the ticks in Westchester County, and Powassan virus can be quite severe.
Very dangerous,
viral
yeah.
illness causing a severe encephalitis and sometimes death. So if you think that about a third of the ticks are carrying more than one human disease-causing infection, then it's reasonable to think that a number of these patients who are getting bitten by ticks and getting Lyme disease are probably carrying more than just the agent of Lyme disease, but perhaps one of these other microbes as well. So some patients do, in fact, have other co-infected diseases like babesiosis that hasn't yet been recognized and can cause prominent fatigue and muscle pain, for example, or headaches. And if you treat the babesiosis, which requires a different type of antibiotic, then all of a sudden the patient starts to get better. So that's the second circle.
I'll keep our audience in suspense a little bit because our listeners know that we divide our podcast into two parts. So in part two with today's guest, Dr. Brian Fallon, he is director of the Center for Neuroinflammatory Disorders and Biobehavioral Medicine and director of the Lyme and Tick-Borne Disease Research Center at Columbia University. We'll continue our discussion of Lyme disease and why patients don't get better and what needs to be done on the Lyme disease research front. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.